KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Some of you may know of Mary Wollstonecraft. She was a pioneering feminist, in some ways the pioneering feminist, of a time when the idea of women having rights was laughable. Wollstonecraft didn't accept that social convention. In fact, she didn't accept many rules, and neither did her daughter, Mary Shelley. Yes, the one who wrote the book Frankenstein. Wollstonecraft died shortly after giving birth to Mary Shelley, but Charlotte Gordon says she still had a profound influence on her daughter's life. Gordon has written a book that explores the intersections in the two women's lives, and today in the program she's joining us to talk about it. Gordon says these women's refusal to bow down and be quiet makes their lives as memorable as the words they left behind. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Mary Wollstonecraft and Mary Shelley had remarkable lives. Wollstonecraft was an activist for women's rights way, way ahead of her time. This was the 18th century. Women couldn't own property. They were legally considered their husband's property. And Wollstonecraft wrote a book you may have heard of course, called A Vindication of the Rights of Women that challenged the social rules and the moral code of the time. Mary Shelley also had radical views about women, and she also pushed up against conventions and expectations. She's maybe best known for writing the novel Frankenstein when she was 19 years old. What most people don't realize is that Mary Shelley was Mary Wollstonecraft's daughter, though Wollstonecraft died just 10 days after giving birth. Charlotte Gordon has written a book that explores the intersecting lives of these two women and the profound influence of the mother on the daughter. And she's joining us today to talk about the book called Romantic Outlaws. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Charlotte Gordon is a literary scholar and historian. She teaches English at Endicott College in Massachusetts. She's written books on the 17th century American poet Anne Bradstreet, and among other things. And she's joining us today from a studio outside of Boston. And Charlotte Gordon, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, I guess we should begin let's start with what you call one of the most famous birth stories in literary history. Because I think it's a good way to start. This is how you sort of jump in the book. And this plays out late August, early September, 1797. Start with that story. Do you mind?
I don't mind at all. In the late summer of 1797, probably the most famous woman in England and even in Europe was pregnant, and she went into labor. And she was anticipating an easy labor. She was in love with her husband. She already had had a child by another man, shocking all of Europe and England because she didn't marry that man. But she was ready. She wanted to have the second baby, and she was ready for a happy life, a good life, and a healthy baby. And she went into labor very confidently. She refused to have a doctor because she thought childbirth was a natural process, and she could handle it herself. Thank you very much. And the birth was hard, but she did have a healthy baby. Everything seemed to be going smoothly, but then she struggled afterward. She had difficulty delivering the placenta, and so a doctor was summoned. And this is an era before germ theory, and the doctor had not washed his hands. He came straight from the hospital, and without knowing it, he introduced the germs of what was then called childbed fever.
Yeah.
But the mother didn't know this. The father didn't know this. And so they were very happy. She settled in with her new little baby who was teeny. Everyone hoped the baby would live. And then 8 days later, the mother, whose name was Mary Wollstonecraft, developed all the symptoms of, in fact, childbed fever, and she died 2 days later, leaving behind this little girl who they had also named Mary. And this little teeny Mary would go on to become Mary Shelley, the author of Frankenstein. It's really a sad story.
Yeah. When did you first learn of the story, I guess? When did you first realize that the two were mother and daughter?
Well, I'm embarrassed to say, Doug, that I did not realize they were mother and daughter throughout most of my undergraduate and graduate school career, despite the fact that I had a terrific education in literature and in history. They were barely mentioned. I'm of the age where women's history was still a new development in universities. And I never studied Wollstonecraft or Shelley in college, even though I was an English major, which I think is shocking. I knew they were connected, but I never realized that they were mother and daughter until about 15 years ago. So when I myself was an English professor and was organizing a women in literature class, that's when I realized that they were mother and daughter. And I think one of the reasons why many, even literary scholars, don't get it is because usually Mary Wollstonecraft is taught, if she's taught, she's taught in 18th century classes as part of the Enlightenment as a political philosopher. And Mary Shelley is taught in the 19th century classes as a romantic figure. Right. And they have historically been seen as two very, very different characters and two very different literary figures. So you would have to be interested in them to know that they were mother and daughter, which I think is pretty shocking, actually.
I think the thing that most surprised me reading about these two characters was Mary Shelley and her own political views. And we'll get into this as we go along. But, I mean, the fact that she chose to focus, as you say in the book, on biography and nonfiction, and clearly that she's so known for this book, Frankenstein, which is not at all about political philosophy. And we'll talk about what it is, in fact, about as we go along. But that was the most surprising part of me, that Mary Shelley was even a radical at all.
I know. After having heard the stories of how her mother and her father, another famous radical, suffered at the hands of conservatives, it's shocking and I think inspirational that Mary Shelley would commit herself to radical causes, especially the cause of women. But she did. And although she didn't know her mother, she very early on dedicated herself to living according to her mother's principles. And when I found out that they were mother and daughter, I was so interested in this that I read all the books on Wollstonecraft that I could find. And when I found out that Wollstonecraft had died, I thought, how could she have influenced her daughter? Because my instincts are telling me that to have had this radical mother was clearly a profound influence on this amazing daughter. And what I realized was that Mary Shelley, whose name when she was little was Mary Godwin, was a reader, and her mother had left behind many, many books, and little Mary Shelley read all of them. She memorized them. And from the time she was a little girl, her father would take her on daily walks to the graveyard, which was near their house, so she could visit her dead mother. And in fact, legend has it that that is where she learned how to read, was on her mother's grave, tracing the letters of her mother's name, which was her name also. So I think she saw it as her mission to continue her mother's ideas, to continue her mother's mission and her mother's fight. And although she wrote novels, her nonfiction is really dedicated to the ideas that women should have a voice, that women had brains, that women had important things to say. And it's pretty astonishing, I think, that she was so brave when both she and her mother faced such punishment and such social exile, really, for speaking their minds. Both were called whores. Both were, I think, really people who couldn't live with themselves if they weren't speaking the truth. And so they were willing to sacrifice a lot of the comforts that more timid people might not have been willing to sacrifice.
You know, you tell the story of Mary Shelley, when she's Mary Godwin, young, comparing herself quite literally to a large portrait of her mother that hung in their home.
So the poignant thing about that portrait is that there was a giant portrait in little Mary Godwin's house, and it was of her mother, Mary Wollstonecraft, pregnant with little Mary.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, so, you know, part of the whole tragedy of the story.
I think what's interesting about it, too, is that, I don't know, I think on some level, I mean, you read also that this is where she goes to her mother's grave, Mary Shelley, to declare her love to Percy, and maybe even to consummate their relationship, which is another kind of weird story altogether. But it kind of borders, I think, maybe because I'm reading it through, you know, today's conventions and eyes, it borders on the creepy a little bit. But she must have spent a lot of time at her mother's grave, because this was an important, I guess, touchstone for her.
It was her special place. I know it does seem creepy to us, I think. But it's really where little Mary Shelley went to seek out solace. Her father remarried about 4 years after Mary Wollstonecraft died. And little Mary really fought with her stepmother. And she felt unloved deeply by this successor to her mother's place.
Yeah.
And really felt, I think, an imaginative and deep connection to this dead mother. So yes, the grave was an important place. And when she met this very handsome and sexy poet named Percy, who inconveniently was already married, but
right,
you know, these
were
romantics. And so we can't let social convention stand in our way. She took him to her special place and broke every rule that there was to break by flinging herself into his arms and saying, "Percy, I'm in love with you." And he said, "Well, I love you too." And she said, "We're going to have to, you know, run away." And he said, "Where?" And she said, "Well, Paris, because that's where my mother went."
Yeah.
And so off they went to Paris. And I think the part that I find sort of funny and poignant yet again is that in their luggage, they took with them not, you know, I don't know what one would take on one's romantic elopement, but I don't know, lingerie or what Mary packed were all of her mother's books. And that's what they did on their honeymoon they, not that they were married, but they read to each other from Mary Wollstonecraft's collected works. And she really, young Mary, really kind of introduced Percy Shelley to the ideas of Mary Wollstonecraft. He knew about her and admired her already, but he became an expert after his relationship with young Mary.
You say in the book that Mary Shelley reimagined the past and recast the future with her mother in this world. She, in a sense, trying to resurrect the dead, I think is how you put it in the book.
Yes. I mean, I think we can certainly see that theme in her famous novel, Frankenstein, is that she really was, I think we could use the word obsessed with this idea of the past, of resurrecting the past. And there were famous experiments that were being done when Mary was a teenager where electricity really seemed to be a harbinger of hope for bringing back the dead. You know, a piece of spaghetti, I think, had been zapped with electricity and moved. And in those days, movement was synonymous with life. So if you saw something move, it meant it was alive. And so both Mary and Percy actually were really interested in this idea. And it was in her, I think, in her unconscious and in her conscious mind from the time she was 15 or 16 years old. But what your listeners may not remember is that she wrote Frankenstein when she was 19 years old.
Yeah. And you say it's a book really about a world without mothers. I mean, there's the science part, which clearly she's saying something about. There was a deep ambivalence that she felt about science. And what were the implications of this, of science? But you say it's mostly about a monster born without a mother, that this monster who is not loved or nurtured becomes violent and becomes cruel, really, because of it.
Yes, you know, his early life, he's certainly not cruel when he's born, so to speak, after he's been manufactured. In fact, he's going around having a young romantic education. He loves nature. Mm-hmm. He loves beauty. He reads Paradise Lost. Mm-hmm. He's searching for his father because he wants to be loved. And his father, Dr. Frankenstein, spurns him. And that's when the cruelty and violence begins. And I think one of the lessons of Frankenstein, on top of, you know, watch out with our scientific, you know, experiments and advances, but one of the real lessons is how we make our own monsters and how important it is that we take care of one another, nurture one another, that we need community, we need relationships, and we need love, and most of all, we need mothers.
Yeah. Let's back up just a bit and to put Mary Wollstonecraft, her time, in context. This was an era of revolution, actual revolution. The American Revolution is going on. The French Revolution is going on. Mary Wollstonecraft covers the French Revolution. So just give us a sense of the time. There's a lot of foment going on.
Mary Wollstonecraft was an extraordinary figure. She was born right in the middle of the 18th century, which was just not a great time to be a woman. If you were a married woman in the 18th century, any property that you had owned on your own right, which was unusual, was immediately your husband's. Women were not allowed to own their own real estate. They weren't allowed to have their own money. Any child that a woman had was automatically considered the property of the father. Divorce was illegal. Steady legal reinforcement of the injustices that women faced. But Mary Wollstonecraft, I think, was born outraged. She was born into kind of an awful family. Her father was an alcoholic. Her mother was weak. She was the eldest daughter. She had a tyrannical older brother. And story goes that young Mary Wollstonecraft would sleep on the threshold of her mother's bedroom to keep her drunken, abusive father out. Yeah. And I think it's that kind of spirit that infused all of her work and all of her life. Later on, when her younger sister married an abusive husband, Mary Wollstonecraft braved the law and helped her sister escape from this husband, even though if she had been caught or if her sister had been caught, they could have gone to prison, they could have gone into an asylum, terrible things could have happened. But that didn't stop Mary Wollstonecraft. When she started reading the political philosophers of the century and understood some of the most important ideas of, for example, John Locke, mm-hmm. that all people are born with a blank slate, men and women alike, that we are equal, she had found philosophical underpinning for her ideas, her sort of her feelings about this was not fair, how women were treated. And her earliest writings really speak to this. She starts by writing about the education of young women, how there need to be more educational opportunities for women. Yeah. Women actually do have brains that could be used and should be used. And she went on to write what was, in her time, the most famous book that she wrote, a treatise called A Vindication of the Rights of Men, not Women. She began with men. And why? Because she was defending the French Revolution, which to her, when it first began, was just the most thrilling and exhilarating event. This is just how the world should be, she felt. Aristocrats should be on the run. Poor people should not be poor, and they should be elevated. Kings should not be tyrants. She was thrilled by the outbreak of the revolution. And when all the British were fleeing home from the violence in Paris, Mary Wollstonecraft left on the first ship she could get onto right. so she could be a foreign war correspondent. A woman
yeah.
being a foreign war correspondent, certainly the first in history, but also just a brave move for a man or a woman. She set up shop in Paris. She heard the king rattle by on his way to trial. She, again, was thrilled to be in this revolutionary society, which I think makes us even seem prim. The Parisians of that time threw all the old traditions out the window, especially marriage. And so when Mary Wollstonecraft, who had never really been in a sexual relationship that had been consummated, when she was in Paris, she met this very sexy and romantic-seeming American named Gilbert Imlay, and they fell in love. And should they get married? Of course not.
Right.
It was a terrible, unjust institution. And so Mary Wollstonecraft felt that she was really living according to her principles by moving in with this man because she was going to be living with her soulmate, her equal. They didn't need this institution to support them. And when she got pregnant, all the better. They were going to create a family based in these new revolutionary principles, and everything was great. And then he abandoned her.
Right.
And tragedy.
Yeah? I'm sorry. I was just going to say, I think that underlines or underscores kind of a theme that you see in the lives of these two women, and that is that there was this balance they had to strike, and they never were terribly successful at it, it seems, between their incredible sense of independence. We can do this alone. And yet, as you put it in the book, their need for love and companionship, like that they never were entirely able to live up to the ideal because it seems like they wanted both. Is that the way to put it?
Oh, that's so well put. Yes. In fact, one of the reasons I was initially interested in Mary Wollstonecraft is here is this woman that I knew as the famous author of A Vindication of the Rights of Woman, who really articulates with force and dignity and tremendous persuasiveness the case for the independence of women. And yet, when I found out about her life, here was this woman who had loved deeply, whose heart had been broken, who was desperately depressed and suicidal when she was abandoned by this lover, Gilbert Imlay. And I thought, it's so amazing to me that these two things go together, this kind of sorrow and desperation over love affairs, and yet this, you know, philosophical and political viewpoint that women should be independent. And I loved the contradiction, mm-hmm. and in fact, stopped seeing it as a contradiction. I see both women as very, very human. And I think that's something that students and readers forget when we just see their name in black and white, you know, that these were three-dimensional people.
Yeah.
With their flaws and their weaknesses. And that's one of the reasons why they're so appealing, I think.
Charlotte Gordon is with us. Her book is called Romantic Outlaws, The Extraordinary Lives of Mary Wollstonecraft and Her Daughter, Mary Shelley. And you can join us if you like, if you have comments or questions. 801-585-WEST is our number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, the story of two amazing women. Mary Wollstonecraft is one, wrote a groundbreaking book about women's rights at a time when no one really thought women had many rights. Wollstonecraft broke almost every rule of polite society in the 18th century. Like the second amazing woman in the show, Mary Shelley, who wrote the book Frankenstein when she was only 19. And the extraordinary thing is also that they happened to be mother and daughter. The scholar Charlotte Gordon has written a book that explores these intersections between the lives of the two women. It's called Romantic Outlaws, The Extraordinary Lives of Mary Wollstonecraft and Her Daughter, Mary Shelley. And Charlotte Gordon is joining us today from a studio outside of Boston. And I wanted to ask you about Mary Wollstonecraft, some relationships early on in Mary Wollstonecraft's life. She has an interesting relationship with a girl at school, Jane Arden. Which seems like a pretty intense relationship. Mary was really exacting about it and really, I wouldn't say cruel maybe, but pretty jealous.
You know, everything that Mary Wollstonecraft did, she did passionately.
Yeah.
And she herself says that, you know, there's no such thing as a light acquaintance or, you know, a casual friendship in Mary Wollstonecraft's life. She fell in love, essentially, with Jane Arden. We don't think that they, you know, consummated this love affair or anything, but they were best friends.
Yeah.
And to Mary, this meant not sharing and telling each other everything. And her heart was continually being broken because Jane would, you know, dare to be nice to someone else. It was, you know, a terrible thing, Mary Wollstonecraft thought. But, you know, it's one of I was thinking as you were giving the biography of both women again that one of the reasons I really wanted to write this book is my experience with students is they look bored when I say the name Mary Wollstonecraft. And I think, bored? Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
She was amazing. She was so passionate, so scandalous. And just even her 14-year-old friendship with Jane is both poignant, funny, passionate, and, you know,
and
sort of.
Can I add confusing?
Yeah.
Because
yes.
I think, because in the sense that, so let's talk about Fanny Blood, which is another relationship she has with a woman. And how do you explain it? Because you say in the book, Mary had this dream of breaking away from her family without getting married. So she wants independence, but she also wants a relationship. And the part of the dream includes setting up a household with Fanny. So how do you explain that? How do you describe that relationship with Fanny?
Well, you know, we would do it so easily today. I think we would, you know, sort of sloppily say, oh, Mary Wollstonecraft must have been bisexual.
Yeah.
But in those days, no one thought like that. So we don't really know what Mary Wollstonecraft's take on the idea of sexual contact with another woman was, because, again, they defined sexuality differently than we do. So holding hands with another woman, even kissing another woman, calling another woman, you know, my darling or you're so beautiful, would not necessarily have been read in sexual terms during this era. So that makes it difficult for a historian to, you know, sort of categorize in modern terms what Mary Wollstonecraft was up to. Yeah. But certainly what we can say just by reading her letters and understanding the decisions she made in her life is she was perfectly prepared. She would have loved to set up her life with her very dear friend Fanny, and that would have been a kind of marriage if Fanny had been open to it. Unfortunately and inconveniently, Fanny was engaged to, you know, Gasp, a man who really was not very prepossessing. And Fanny died, which broke Mary's heart again. But I think Mary really was a passionate person. And what was most important to her was that kind of spiritual soulmate quality. But she also wanted physical contact. She did want a passionate, loving relationship. And my assumption is that even with her 14-year-old girlhood friend, I'm sure there was lots of hand-holding and hugging and probably kissing that went on that, again, we would categorize as sexual. I'm not sure that Mary Wollstonecraft would have. But she loved these women as passionately as she loved the men later in her life.
It's interesting that her relationship with William Godwin – I wonder how you see that, because he had a pretty radical political point of view. It changes, it evolves, and we'll get to that in a moment. But I mean, he publishes this essay, I think it's an essay called Political Justice, where he argues basically that all government should be abolished, basically. I mean, this is like a radical libertarian almost in his, I mean, how do you describe his political view?
That's such a great question. Thank you. He's actually known traditionally as the father of anarchy.
Yeah.
And yet a more rigid individual you have never met. I mean, he was raised by this Calvinist family to be a minister. And for much of his 20s, he dressed like a minister. He kind of lived like a Calvinist. You know, he kind of disapproved of eating too much or drinking too much. His schedule, he could never vary from his schedule. You know, he would work, and he didn't want anyone to talk to him while he was working until after lunch, when he would go for a long walk, and then only in the afternoon and evening could he be social. So I always think it's so ironic that the father of anarchy lived his life according to really sort of these rigid rules. Mm-hmm. But what's sort of fabulous about William Godwin politically is he, especially as a young man, believed that human beings were inherently good. They didn't need to be governed. That if you believe that someone is going to be virtuous if you leave them, you know, to their own devices, what need is there for government except to oppress people? And this really drew Mary Wollstonecraft, who shared some of that kind of optimism. I mean, it's an Enlightenment optimism, but it's kind of a beautiful belief. She loved that idea. And he also was an early proponent for the freedom and education of women. Mm. But the irony, of course, is that he was still a product of his age. And as you said, his ideas and feelings about the education of women and the independence of women does change over time. But we can talk about that later.
Yeah, we'll get to that.
If people are interested.
It seems tragic, I have to say, on some level, because it's almost like he betrays her ideals in the end. But it's interesting, too, that Gilbert Imlay, she falls in love with, doesn't feel any need when she's in Paris, and doesn't feel any need to get married to him. She has his baby, and then he, of course, abandons her. But she does get married to William, she, even though she doesn't necessarily believe it's necessary as an institution. She does bow to this one convention. Do you think you understand why?
Yeah, you know, what's so interesting about Mary Wollstonecraft is that after she's abandoned by Gilbert, she's just desperate. and I won't give away some of the terrible things that she does, but Gilbert, who really comes down to us as a pretty self-absorbed, I don't know, cad, to use an old-fashioned word, he has this brilliant idea that Mary Wollstonecraft should do him a favor. And what he says to her is this. He says, "Mary, you know, I know we're no longer together, but as you know, my business is very important to me, and one of my ships has gone missing in Scandinavia, and I'm wondering if you could go off to Scandinavia and help track this ship down, because maybe if you find the ship, I'll be less preoccupied with business, and, you know, who knows, maybe we could get back together again." Mary Wollstonecraft is thrilled with this idea. She goes on a ship to Scandinavia, and Doug, no one in 18th century England went to Scandinavia. I mean, men didn't go to Scandinavia, let alone a single mom with her toddler. But yeah, that's what Mary Wollstonecraft did. And it was beautiful when she got there. So although her heart had been broken by Gilbert, she still took the time to wander around in nature and smell the pines and admire the waterfalls. And she wrote many angry letters to Gilbert, telling him what an idiot he was not to be with her, and lambasting him for falling away from their philosophical principles. What was wrong with him? He was clearly wrong, and she was clearly right. But she also noticed that when she wandered around in nature and, you know, looked at the beautiful waterfalls and smelled the pine trees, that she felt better. And she would come home and write about that as well. And when she returned to London, she hadn't found his ship. Gilbert, by this time, had taken up with a beautiful young actress. She was horrified. But she was resilient enough and strong enough to put together her writings from Scandinavia into a smaller book than she had written before. It was called Letters from Scandinavia, and it's really brief essays about what it was like to be in Scandinavia, wandering around with a broken heart, and yet taking great solace from nature and having sort of greater capacity for self-reflection. And two young poets, William Wordsworth and Samuel Taylor Coleridge, read this book, and they thought, we want to write like this. And romanticism was born.
Yeah.
And this is, again, not what you're taught in college, at least not what I was taught in college. I was taught that romanticism began with William Wordsworth. Mary Wollstonecraft was never mentioned. And I couldn't believe it when I was reading these letters. I couldn't believe that she had never been taught as kind of the founder of romanticism. But at any rate, how is it that she ended up with William Godwin, and why would she have married him? He read this book and kind of fell in love with her through this book. And as their relationship evolved, it was kind of a safer relationship for Mary than Gilbert. William Godwin was not charming or sexy at all. He was rigid. He was kind of awkward, certainly awkward socially. He'd never had a relationship with a woman ever before, so that was kind of delicate. She'd had experience, i.e. sexual experience, and he hadn't. I don't think he'd even barely kissed a woman before. And these are two early middle-aged people. So this was all very awkward. But they do get together, as you know. She does get pregnant. But she knew, and he knew by the time she was pregnant with this second child, that life would be terribly hard for this baby, for this new baby, if this child was born out of wedlock. And so they both bowed to social convention. As Godwin put it, we live during flawed times, right, and we're going to have to, you know, live according to the conventions of our time. But both thought that marriage was terrible for women. And I think they really only did it to protect the new child so that the new child would have, you know, a legitimate background. Though it's so funny because to be the child of Mary Wollstonecraft and William Godwin was certainly not going to ensure the child's acceptance in the conservative circles.
That's true.
Another thing I noticed was how many cads there are in the lives of these two poor women. Percy's a cad, and Lord Byron's a cad, and Gilbert's a cad. So many self-involved jerks in their lives. I mean, was that unusual for the time? I mean, not that they made bad choices, but it seems like they did. I mean, these guys were jerks.
Well, you know, I started the book thinking the guys were jerks, but I think part of writing a book like this is you really have to enter into the lives of all of the characters involved. And I really came to love all of them. I loved Percy. I loved Godwin. Perhaps the one I didn't come to love is Gilbert Imlay.
Yeah.
But I could kind of understand their point of view as well. You know, Percy was truly a sufferer himself. He was on his own pilgrimage to find his own way, to find his own ideas, to find his own place in the world. And, you know, what a terrible man to marry or to be involved with. And yet, did he act out of malice? I don't think so. I think he acted out of his own suffering. And Godwin, what a limited, awkward, social guy he was. I mean, again, did he act out of malice? No, I don't think so. He acted out of his own tremendous limitations. Ugh. But, you know, they had no cultural support evolve as men. There were no men's groups.
right. I do think it's interesting, too, how Mary Shelley, she really reforms Percy Shelley's relationship after he dies. I mean, eventually she turns him, I can't remember exactly how you put it, but she turns him from being this scandalized person to a Victorian martyr, I think is how you put it. And she really turns his relationship or his reputation around, it seems.
She really does. I mean, it's one of her, I don't know if we want to call it greatest. We could call it significant. One of her greatest achievements or creations is Percy Shelley.
Yeah.
So not only was she a great novelist, not only did she create this story of Frankenstein that's really become iconic in our culture, but she also created the image, really, or the idea of this poet, this angelic, otherworldly spirit named Percy Shelley, which this image really has very little to do with Percy Shelley, who had a gazillion affairs with a gazillion women and perhaps men who delighted in shocking people. That was his favorite activity, who was dedicated to revolution in every form he could find, who really, in his own time, was known as an atheist, was one of the few fathers in legal history in England to be denied custody of his children by yet another woman, his first wife. He really was not the figure that Mary paints after he dies. And the irony of this, of course, is that she gets kind of co-opted, or in readers' minds, she becomes associated with this kind of angelic figure that she's created, Percy Shelley, and people begin to see her as this kind of prim and proper Victorian wife, which was never Mary Shelley either. I mean, she was this crazy 16-year-old who jumped into Percy's arms, a married man, and said, let's run away together.
Yeah.
She was not a prim Victorian.
How did you see the trajectory of the relationship? I mean, it ends tragically when he dies in a boating accident. But did you see the relationship as at all sustainable? Could it have really lasted? I mean, you also mentioned how they didn't seem to be sleeping together. Mary had blamed him for the deaths of some of her children. She seemed finished with him on some level. Is that right?
That's a terrific question. I don't think anyone has ever asked me that before, and I've wondered that so much, and in fact had to cut my speculations, you know, from the book, because really the book is already, you know, so filled with scandal and romance. It didn't need my speculations about what would have happened if Percy had gone on living. I didn't have room for that. But, you know, I think one of the interesting things about this book for me and in writing this book was, of course, the literary history is very important, but what I was really entranced by were their relationships. And you know, marriage is complicated, isn't it? And especially during an era when divorce was essentially illegal. I think they would have stayed married, and I think they were deeply connected as literary creators. And I think there probably would have been a tacit agreement that he could have his affairs and she could have his affairs. Mm-hmm. Would they have continued to live in the same house? Yeah, I think so. Would other people always have been in and out of that house? Yes, I think so. But there was a deep companionship, perhaps, or deep mutual respect and a shared history that I think would always have kept them in some important relationship, perhaps not what we would now conventionally think of as marriage, i.e. I'm not sure they would have gone on having sex together. Mm-hmm. I think she was pretty through with that after all the losses she had sustained. But she might have come back to life, and they might have had more babies.
Yeah. It was such an experiment, this idea of free love. You know, Percy had impregnated a number of women, among them Claire, Mary's stepsister. He had his first wife that, who was – and everything ends so tragically in that story. I mean, of course, and there are all these suicides. And it does raise a question that, that came up that I did want to ask you about, this – idea of so many people. This was in a romantic era, so the idea of dying romantically, suicide in some of these cases seemed to be such a, I don't know, such a thing. And I wonder what you made of that. And there was that question whether Percy himself had intended, when he died, was when he was capsized, if he had in fact had a death wish and those kinds of things. I mean, what do you make of that part of the story?
I think that most of the suicides, you know, although that is a point that some people make about Shelley himself, most of the suicides in the book are women. And I think it's a symptom of what it was like to be a woman in the 18th and 19th century, that really one's options were so limited and love affairs were all you had if you were a middle class or upper class woman, because, you know, you couldn't be a doctor. You weren't supposed to be a writer. I mean, Mary Wollstonecraft and Mary Shelley were breaking the rules by being creative artists and political thinkers, but they weren't supposed to. They were supposed to be decorative. They were supposed to be attractive to men, and they were defined by their love affairs and their marriages. And so when those didn't work, who were they? Hence, we have suicides. And I think that the suicides in this book were just the tip of the iceberg. And I think I say in the book that, in fact, Mary Wollstonecraft, who had wanted to die, was rescued from one of her plunges into the River Thames because the government was so upset about all the women who were throwing themselves into the river that they had instituted a reward program so that people would lurk along the banks of the Thames to scoop out any women who had jumped off, you know, a bridge to try to die. But it was a pretty miserable time to be a woman. So I think I saw it in historical context and as a kind of cultural symptom, lest I ever forget that it was pretty tough to be alive during this era that I was writing about. All I had to do was look at the statistics of female suicide, and it just reinforced for me how brave my women were, what brave women they were.
Charlotte Gordon is with us. Her book is Romantic Outlaws, The Extraordinary Lives of Mary Wollstonecraft and Her Daughter Mary Shelley. And we need to take another quick break, but we'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. I'm back now with the scholar and historian Charlotte Gordon. We're talking about her book, Romantic Outlaws, The Extraordinary Lives of Mary Wollstonecraft and Her Daughter, Mary Shelley. So, yeah, William Godwin is disappointing. I have to say he disappoints us. I mean, he does such damage to Mary Wollstonecraft's reputation after she dies. I mean, he's so on board with vindication. As a book, as in an idea. He falls in love with her and her radical ideas. And then after she dies, he changes, he remarries, he becomes more conservative, and he ends up calling the book, which is so groundbreaking, he starts calling it flawed, calls it sentimental and having flawed by sentiments rather than masculine description. Is how he puts it. Talk a little bit about that, because this seems like such a shame.
Yes, you. But that is. I think it's funny. Maybe it's because I'm a writer. But one of the things that I found most infuriating about this time period is that the words masculine and feminine were used. Yeah. First of all, is that feminine was a bad word. Like, to be feminine was to be weak, stupid, irrational. Sinful. To be masculine was to be strong, to be virtuous, to be filled with integrity. And Godwin always felt, actually, that Wollstonecraft didn't write with enough masculinity. His giant book, Political Justice, was, you know, architectural in its scope. I mean, it was enormous, and it was you know, basically a fleshed, I shouldn't say a fleshed out outline, but it was very systematic. He was writing political philosophy. He was also a novelist, but he was very interested in proving, you know, his points using logic, using reason, etc. And when you read him, you can see that. And what's so interesting to me is he was a superstar then, but not many people read William Godwin today, whereas people still read Mary Wollstonecraft. And why is that? Mary Wollstonecraft was far more really of a Democrat than William Godwin for all of his belief that there shouldn't be government. Mary Wollstonecraft felt like writers should write from their heart and their gut. And why? Because that way they could connect to their reader. She also felt like not everyone, i.e. women and marginalized peoples, had had the benefit of a fancy education. And logic and rhetoric, those were the sort of tools of the privileged. She hadn't gotten an education. She was a self-educated person. And she wrote sort of, I don't know, by the skin of her teeth through sheer bravery. And you can hear her voice, therefore, when she writes. And I think that's one of the reasons why we still read her, is she'll say in the middle of a political treatise, she'll say, nonsense, that's foolishness. Or, you know, who could agree with Rousseau on this? And you hear her in kind of this great human way that we lose in the writings of William Godwin for all of their, you know, well-reasoned paragraphs. I think his prose works can be pretty tough to slog through, even for literary scholars. I think that when Godwin kind of wrecked Mary Wollstonecraft's reputation, which he did, he started, I forget now, I think it was as close to 10 days after she died. He refused to go to the funeral. There was only a funeral because his friends and hers insisted on it. And he would not go because he did not believe in God. He thought church was for the weak. He didn't need any crutches like that. Instead, he got out his pen and he started writing what he called a memoir of the author of A Vindication of the Rights of Woman. Yeah. And because he was such a principled guy, I think he really thought he was doing a good thing. He was going to tell the truth, but he believed in stuff like the truth. And where did the truth come from? His own experience. He didn't really interview anyone as he wrote this book that was supposed to be telling the true story of Mary Wollstonecraft's life. So he ended up telling all about her sexual escapades with other men, not all of which had a firm basis in reality. And the net result was that Mary Wollstonecraft, who had died as one of the most famous women of her time, suddenly became known by everyone as a whore, not just her enemies. So when she had published A Vindication of the Rights of Woman, she'd been called, you know, a hyena in petticoats, right, and, you know, a totally scandalous figure. But liberals and radicals supported her and saw her as a force to be contended with. But after this terrible a book that Godwin wrote exposing, as he, as the audience saw it or as the reader saw it, all of her sexual adventures, no one wanted to read her anymore. And we almost lost her. That's one of the other poignant things about her. This very important woman almost got buried in history because no one who came after her wanted to be associated with this scandalous reputation that she had, except for, of course, her daughter. And the reason why we do still have her is thanks to Mary Shelley, but also this kind of secret sisterhood of women writers who passed her down through their own writing. So George Eliot, Elizabeth Barrett Browning, and then most famously Virginia Woolf in the early 20th century made sure that we did not forget Mary Wollstonecraft and her contributions to literary history and history in general. Thank goodness.
Yeah. And after Mary Shelley dies, her reputation goes through this this transformation, and not a good one. I mean, she comes to be seen as only connected to her husband, and her writing came to be seen as kind of trivial. I mean, people forgot about the fact that she was this radical, had these political viewpoints that she and as you say in the book, she came to be seen as straying from her mother's ideals, came to be seen as a coward, as a sellout. That's another shame in this story.
Yes, you know, they both suffered the worst things that could happen to a woman writer's reputation. So Mary Wollstonecraft was known as a whore. In fact, if you looked up whore in the 19th century English dictionaries, it would say see Mary Wollstonecraft.
No.
She really was almost ruined because of her personal life. Mary Shelley had the opposite problem. Now, she too had been called a whore because she'd run away with a married man. She was very close friends with Byron. Everyone assumed that she had a love affair with him, which she did not. But she was known as a whore during her early years. But as she crafted this image of Percy Shelley, the Victorian angel, people began to see her also as the perfect Victorian wife. Mm-hmm. And that's for many, many reasons, which we don't have time to go into. But, you know, she was living during a much more conservative time than her mother's era. Her mother's era was a revolutionary time. And Mary Shelley, her final years were spent during the very, very, very conservative Victorian era. And she had to learn how to embed her ideas and her truths in kind of socially acceptable forms. And so she was the only woman, for example, who wrote for the first English encyclopedia because she was such a serious intellectual. She was fluent in Italian and French and Spanish. She knew ancient Greek. She was amazing. And she wanted to write the lives of women for this encyclopedia. But when she proposed this idea, the encyclopedia founder said, "Are you kidding me? It's a terrible idea. There are no distinguished women. Just write about men." So she would write about the men, but inside the stories of the men, she would embed the amazing women. And so that, you know, you think you're reading the biography of Montaigne, but suddenly you encounter his much more amazing niece, Marie, who was a poet and an editor in her own right. And you find that Mary Shelley was, in fact, a serious intellectual. And where did that all go after she died? Well, she had a daughter-in-law who really was worried that people would criticize Mary Shelley for her early behavior, for running away with Percy Shelley, who was already married, and for living with him out of wedlock for many years. And her daughter-in-law did her best to destroy all the evidence of Mary Shelley's early, you know, bad behavior. And so really, we didn't know about Mary Shelley until the 20th century. We didn't know these details of her life, and we certainly didn't know what a serious intellectual she was. You know, she went on to write 5 more novels after Frankenstein. And her nonfiction is very, very important. And most people don't read it today.
Charlotte Gordon. She is an associate professor of English at Endicott College. Her book is Romantic Outlaws, The Extraordinary Lives of Mary Wollstonecraft and Her Daughter, Mary Shelley. Charlotte Gordon, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you. I was delighted to get to talk about these two amazing women.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Thank you.